Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, I talk to Bridgerton's breakout star, Claudia Jessi, about playing Eloise Bridgerton and falling out with Penelope Featherington. The new Dublin gangland set movie, Twig, set to a Greek tragic background. I talk to its director and writer, Marion Quinn. Plus, Chris Rosser reviews Austin Butler and the Bike Riders, as well as the new Roger Federer documentary. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well. Last week we reviewed Inside Out 2. I hadn't seen it. Neve O'Reilly gave it 3 stars, a strong 3 stars. I have subsequently seen it with my 8-year-old daughter, and I really liked it. I could nearly go to 4. And I mention it because it was watched, it made over $1 million here already. And it seems to be a summer blockbuster so far, all about the young girl, Riley, and the emotions that are visualized inside her mind. And, you know, Neve was saying it's lovely, but it's very similar to the first one. And it is. But it's delightful. There's a real, real charm to it. And some of the new emotions are really funny. And in particular, ennui. There's this new French character. And it's kind of a form of, you know, teenage ennui that's inside Riley. And there's also anxiety now. It's delightful. It looks great. There's plenty in it for the parents if you are going to take a child with you. And, you know, it's has some nice messaging about, you know, surviving the tough times that can befall a teenager. So a big thumbs up for Inside Out 2, which is still very much in cinemas. I have to mention at the start of the show, the sad passing of the great Donald Sutherland, whose death was announced earlier this week, aged 88. What do you say about Donald Sutherland? He was in some of the greatest movies of all time, MASH, Don't Look Now, Ordinary People, late appearances in The Hunger Games, just a brilliant actor with utter gravitas on screen, and seemed like a lovely guy. And, you know, if you're going to watch anything this weekend outside of the movies, our old friend on this show, Mark Cousins, did a brilliant interview with him in his Scene by Scene series, and he was just a delight to be around. And so that's on YouTube, as far as I know. You can watch it, or certainly part of it. But RIP, and if there was a movie where you wanted to see what a great actor he was, Don't Look Now, I think. But a great, great actor and a sad loss. Now, this week in TV, I was watching this.
One thing that was very telling that Bob said, he said, all my life, I've had more money than I could spend, and it didn't make me happy.
She talked on the telephone with her husband, then she vanished. And no one has seen Kathleen Durst since.
Durst was wanted for murder in Texas. He was a suspect for murders in Los Angeles, Westchester County, New York.
He belongs to one of the richest families in New York City.
Might be a little eccentric.
I think Bob is very smart. I mean, he's managed to get away with 3 murders.
He is being unfairly accused. Bob Durst may be the unluckiest man in the world.
Not tell the whole truth. Nobody tells the whole truth.
Now, that is a clip from The Jinx, which it's actually called The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. Now, I'm late to the party in terms of this, in that the first season of this launched in 2015. And in a way, we really don't have time to go into it all now, because you could write a thesis about The Jinx. It's on Sky Documentaries. It's in your Sky box. You can find it on Now TV as well. And long story short, it tells the incredible story of Robert Durst, who was convicted of murdering a neighbor of his, was accused of murdering his first wife, Kathy Durst, also accused of murdering his friend 20 years after that. He was the son of a real estate magnate in Manhattan. Andrew Jarecki, who gave us Capturing the Freedman, sat down with him for 3 days of interviewing and has made a remarkable series that is too far-fetched to be fiction. I was talking to Pat Kenny about it this week on the series Boxed, and we were making that point that if this was, you know, a movie, you wouldn't really believe it. You say it was too far-fetched. And there are moments in this two parts of this documentary where you can't really believe what's been captured on screen. So if you haven't seen The Jinx, do yourself a favor. It is remarkable viewing. Now, there are ethical questions with it in terms of its voyeurism around true crime. Also, maybe in some ways, how the series was sequenced and what you're seeing in terms of what actually happened. That notwithstanding, it is remarkable watching, to the point that the documentary was used as part of a continuing trial that was held against Robert Durst, or that Robert Durst was involved in. So this is really prestige documentary making. So The Jinx, you may well have seen this, and I'm already preaching to the converted, available to watch on Sky and Now TV. Let me know if you might have watched it. John_Fardy on Twitter, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talks TV and movie show, and we turn to the week's new film releases, and chief among them is The Bike Riders, a new Jeff Nichols movie all about, well, bike riders in the 60s, starring Austin Butler, and a new documentary from the great Asif Kapadia all about Roger Federer, called Roger Federer, The Final 12 Days. To make sense of all this, I'm joined by film critic and arts critic Chris Wasser. Chris, hello.
John, hello. How are you?
Very well. So The Bike Riders, fascinating stuff in that it's loosely based on a true story. And now, I've only seen clips of this, but correct me if I'm wrong. It was initially a gang of bikers came together as a social club, but then it became much more serious than that.
Yeah, they came together first as, you know, all of these kind of oddballs and outcasts, but these like-minded men around Chicago, around Illinois, who just wanted to get together to share their love of motorcycles and motorcycle culture, and to ride together and to drink beers together, you know, all frequent the same bar, shoot some pool, tell all of their stories. I was going to say tell their war stories, and in some cases, you know, these guys really did have war stories, but it was all documented.
So like a men's shed for bikers.
Pretty much, yeah. You know, it started out innocently enough, but, you know, any motorcycle club in the 1960s, in 1960s America would probably have started out innocently enough, and then it all kind of descended into, you know, criminal chaos. But with the biker gang at the center of Jeff Nichols' film, they are a fictional gang, but they are directly inspired by a real life gang called the Outlaws. It's the Vandals in the film, but it's the Outlaws in real life. And Jeff Nichols is working very closely with a real photography book by photojournalist Danny Lyon, who in 1967 published this book called The Bike Riders, after spending, you know, after spending years on and off interviewing the members of the Outlaws Club in Illcook, Illinois. He spent some time on the road with them. He photographed them. And, you know, although there are interview segments and there are tapes and there was an awful lot of audio for Jeff Nichols to work with, they are largely working with the wonderful images in this book. It has that factual blueprint there, but Jeff Nichols has decided, well, I'm going to tell a fictional story. So basically what I'm trying to say, John, is everything in this film you should kind of take with a pinch of salt. He has been doing interviews where he says that, you know, a great deal of the dialogue was inspired by the audio tapes, but the story itself is largely fictional.
And leading up that story is Austin Butler and Tom Hardy. And we also have Jodie Comer.
We do. And it's actually an unusual love triangle, or at least that's how it feels at times. So the story, you know, I'm actually going to make it sound a little bit more straightforward than it is, because an awful lot of this film kind of bounces around the place. And you have Jodie Comer's narrating it a little bit, and it goes back and forth. You know, it actually gives Jeff Nichols has created, you know, a Danny Lyon character where he has Mike Face playing the photojournalist interviewing the bikers. But the story as it is, it follows this guy named Benny, who's just the smoothest operator in any room. He's just this devilishly handsome biker figure who doesn't really say anything. He's this strong, silent type, and he never really lifts his head for anything other than a fight. But that all changes when, at the bar where the Vandals drink, one night Jodie Comer's Kathy walks in, and she's just walking in to, you know, deliver a message to a friend. She doesn't really know anything about these bikers or about bikes, and she sees Benny, and, you know, it's Austin Butler as Benny, John, so you're going to be instantly smitten. And, you know, the feeling is mutual for Benny. And within 5 weeks, they're married, and she kind of signs up to this life of, you know, this biker gang lifestyle without really knowing anything about it. She has to, though, share Benny with the president of the club, and that's Johnny. And Johnny was, Johnny was inspired to kickstart the Vandals. He already was a bit of a biker. He was a bit of a racer, but he was sitting around one night as the film show was watching The Wild One. And he was just so inspired by Marlon Brando's performance in that he wanted to start the club. And as I say, the club at the beginning, you know, it is just this space. It is this, you know, men's shed space where these guys can ride together and drink together. And they go to different circuits, they visit other gangs, and they get involved in scraps, but it's all innocent. Anyone who they fight, they end up having a drink with afterwards and kind of nursing their bruises together. But it all starts to go south after this one incident where Benny is drinking in a bar that he shouldn't be. And you have these rival bikers saying, take off the Vandal's jacket. He won't do that. So they beat him within an inch of his life. And that sort of lights this awful fire within Johnny, where he realizes, okay, you know, you messed with one of my lads, I'm going to mess with yours. And once they get their revenge, Johnny has a taste for, you know, that kind of criminal lifestyle, and it all kind of descends into chaos. So we see the Vandals over a number of years, because this story is set, you know, somewhere between like 6 and 10 years, turn from this, you know, kind of, as I say, this innocent motorcycle club culture fixture to, you know, a proper outlaw gangster group, you know, and they're getting themselves into all sorts of trouble. And you also have Kathy kind of knowing that there's only one way this might end for Benny.
And, you know, you mentioned The Wild One there, that he was inspired by this. Is this, and I don't mean this as a criticism, but is this an old-fashioned kind of biker tale? Because it's set in 1965 Chicago, and I was thinking of The Wild One before you even said it, and maybe Easy Rider, although Easy Rider is a different kind of movie. But is it a straight-ahead, you know, biker movie with good guys and bad guys in a love triangle?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. And the love triangle, as I said, is a bit unusual, because at times you think that Johnny is sort of a father figure for Benny and Benny looks up to him. But there's this connection between them that maybe Kathy even knows is an awful lot deeper than the one that she has with Benny. So it's almost like she's constantly fighting for her husband's attention there. So that's fascinating. And also just the look of it and the way the story plays out, it is quite an old school biker film, but also an old school gangster film. And you might have seen that, you know, an awful lot of critics have been making comparisons to Goodfellas. Those comparisons are inevitable, because from the very beginning, you have this freeze frame opening where we meet the young, handsome, you know, would-be gangster of the piece. We have his partner's narration, and we have the title sequence coming up over a frozen shot of that gangster getting himself into trouble. Straight away, you know you're in Goodfellas territory. And the way the story plays out, it's almost like that. But I actually admire Nichols for that, because he says it himself. That film was such a huge influence, and he kind of wanted to create his own. And I'm not saying that he's a copycat here. I feel as though he was doing that to just get all of those comparisons out of the way, to just say, yeah, look, I know what I'm trying to do here. I'm very much aware of it. So if he's kind of, you know, pointing it out, then we don't need to point it out for him. I should say as well, there are times in this film where, and I got on very well with this, John, but there are times where it feels like parts are missing from the story. And I actually thought I was a little bit frustrated with that at the beginning, but once it sat with me for a while afterwards, I realized that it's called The Bike Riders, and the book was all images of bikers, and you were kind of filling in the blanks, and you were kind of wondering, you know, because no one ever saw Benny's face. The images of Benny the images of this character who's called Benny in the film, or in real life, we don't know what the name was. In the book, you only ever see, you know, a silhouette, or his head is turned away from the camera. And you're kind of filling in the blanks. And I think that's what Nichols is trying to do here. He's giving you these wonderful images, you know, and he's kind of like, and it's very lightly plotted, and it's up to you to kind of think, okay, what do these guys do during the week? You know, and what's Johnny like away from home, away from the gang? And I think it's okay that Nichols didn't show us that. So some of the things, basically, John, what I'm trying to say is that frustrated me about the story at first. Once it sat with me, I thought, actually, I like what Nichols did there.
Yeah. And tell me this, Austin Butler, you know, I just think he's great. I mean, I interviewed him for Elvis, and it felt like I was actually talking to Elvis, but I don't mean that as a criticism. I think he might have gone full method. Then I saw him in Dune Part 2. Like, he's a very exciting actor. I know he's devilishly handsome and all that. I presume he pulls it off then.
He really does, yeah. He does an awful lot here without saying much, because, again, it's all about the imagery. And sometimes you think, is this a little bit too style? You know, is this style over substance? But I don't think it is. It's a wonderful performance, and I think it's the... whatever about Dune, it's the first one where, you know, because it's the I suppose there's all that heavy makeup in Dune, and it's not really the Austin Butler show. But this is a different, another chance for him to show that I can do more than a wonderful impersonation. You know, this is a terrific performance. I actually interviewed him for this film, and I will say you genuinely feel cooler around him in his company. you want to go off with him and have a few beers and shoot some pool and hear his story. But yeah, I thought he was brilliant here. I thought he works very well with Jodie Comer. She's terrific. She's our narrator, and she's kind of carrying us through the story. But actually, the film works an awful lot better when Jeff Nichols just lets it breathe, and when he just follows all of these bikers and their various stories. One of the best scenes in the picture is when they're off on this biker picnic weekend. I can't really figure out what it is, but they're all having beers and eating chicken together. And they're sitting around the campfire, and you've got Michael Shannon, who's been in all six of Jeff Nichols' films. He's sort of like he's his most consistent collaborator. I sometimes think he's his muse, but you've got his character Zipko telling this story about how he wasn't allowed to go fight in Vietnam. That he went and did the physical, and he went and did all the tests, and he was turned away because he was told he wasn't a suitable candidate. And all of the guys are kind of laughing at him, but he's not telling a funny story. He's actually explaining that he's never really felt as though he's belonged anywhere. And it turns out all of the guys have kind of similar stories. So there's actually like a layer of sadness and anger behind this film. I mean, it looks like a flashy, fun biker film, but it's that sort of stuff where you realize that these guys are just lost, lonely souls looking to find their tribe, looking to find somewhere where they belong. That's what makes a difference. So I will say this film makes an awful lot of noise. You know, the engine noise will stay with you. You can smell the oil and the cigarettes off it, but it's the heartache behind all that that sticks with you.
That sounds great. It really does. In 30 seconds, tell me this, right? Tom Hardy, I haven't seen it, but I watch clips. Is the accent, it struck me a little awry, but I could be wrong. I watch clips as opposed to the whole movie.
I'm okay with it. I'm okay. Look, I'm fully subscribed to the Tom Hardy does a silly voice in Film Club, you know, and I think this is, I think he has a get out of jail free card here, because we see the scene where he is so fixated on Brando. He's a total Brando nut. So it's almost, again, Nichols telling you, look, this guy wants to be Brando. So if Tom Hardy wants to put on a Brando voice, that's okay.
Who are we to argue? Okay, yeah. Well, look, that sounds like small things to argue over. So what are you going to say stars-wise for the bike riders?
I just found it to be this mesmerizing tale of just masculinity and motorcycle culture in 1960s America. I found it very educational and informative, because I know nothing about bikes. And by the time it finished, John, I wanted to build my own bike. So it worked on me. It's such a handsome film, beautifully performed, brilliantly designed and staged. I think it's 4 stars.
Wow, that should be on the poster, the movie that turned Chris Wasser into a gearhead. It's also the movie that's causing you to out-name drop me, which you should never do, you know. But when I Austin Butler last week for the new movie we're talking about, but that sounds terrific. That is 4 stars for The Bike Riders, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 21st of June, and we better take a clip.
You can't have him.
Who?
You know exactly who I'm talking about, Benny. You can't have him. The club can't have him. He's mine. You know, and if he keeps riding motorcycles, he's gonna die one way or another. It'll kill him, and you know this is true.
What am I supposed to do about it? You know, I don't run Benny, just like you don't run Benny. Ain't nobody can tell that kid nothing. He's grown. He wants to ride a bike. He'll ride a bike.
Well, not if you tell him, Johnny. Not if you tell him he's out of the club.
Come on.
No, he's mine, Johnny, mine. I'm his wife, not you.
Is that supposed to mean?
Oh, I know you love him. I love him too. That's why you got to do this.
A clip there of The Bike Riders on general release from this Friday, the 21st of June, which Chris Wasser is giving a very strong 4 to, and it sounds terrific. So, Chris, Asif Kapadia has given, to my mind, the world to the greatest, I guess they're sporting documentaries, but they're people documentaries of all time, in the form of Diego Maradona and his documentary about Senna. I mean, Amy was possibly less successful, but still a great watch all in all. He's now turned his camera on Roger Federer, who's very much alive and still of this earth, but has, you know, not died, but his career is coming to an end. And that's what this is all about.
That is what this is all about. So the clue is in the title, Federer 12 Final Days. It's the final fortnight, let's say, of Roger Federer's professional tennis career. Going from the moment where he decided, no, really, this is it. I am bowing out. It was a knee injury in the end that got him. He'd had, you know, 22, maybe 23 years on top. And then one day his knee just went on him. And that was kind of his body letting him know, you've done all you can here. And he had such an extra. I'm not a huge tennis fan, but I know that Roger Federer is one of the greatest professional athletes of all time. So he was ready to call it quits. First of all, he had to write a letter. He wanted to write a letter that he would post to social media a week or 10 days before the Laver Cup in London. So this letter went out. His family were all around him, his agent, everyone involved in the Roger Federer brand. They all then took the trip to London to the Laver Cup, where he would play a doubles match alongside his sort of BFF / rival, Rafael Nadal. And all of the, you know, Andy Murray will be there. All the greatest tennis players, all the greatest male tennis players in the world will be there to compete in this tournament, but also to take a step back and watch Federer play his final game. So this was actually an idea that the Federer camp had, that they wanted to document his final days in tennis. That sounds very, very, very dramatic, his final days, but his final days as a tennis player. He wanted to document it just for himself, and just so that his kids, when they grew up, they could watch it. And he claims
sorry to cut across you, it could also sound, I'm not suggesting it is, but self-aggrandizing.
It is. And I mean, the whole thing is so glossy and controlled. So it probably won't be surprised to hear that Asif Kapadia, he actually wasn't involved from the beginning. What you actually had was Joe Sabia, who's sort of a content creator. He's the guy who created and hosts those 73 Questions Vogue videos, which, you know, are fluffy and enjoyable, but they're not very... you don't really ever get much out of them about the subject, because the subject always kind of has to approve the questions. You know, they're all very glossy. He actually filmed this and he documented these 12 final days. And I'm not sure if Asif was involved in the making of it, but he was called in the second half to kind of fill out, because a decision was made that this is not just going to be a film that will be watched by Federer and his family. We're going to release this in cinemas. We're going to release this on Prime. We're going to do a deal here. And in order to do that, they needed to pad it out a little bit, and they wanted to incorporate archive footage. And I mean, Kapadia has shown himself to be a master documentary maker, but also a very good filmmaker when it comes to taking existing footage and making, you know, a clean narrative out of that. So you can see the little bits where this is Asif at work and this is Joe and the Federer camp. Do they come together okay? Not always. John, there are times where I wish Asif was just running the entire show, but I think that would have been a very different film. It's all just a little bit too clean. It's all, you know, it's afraid of getting its hands dirty. Maybe there is no way of getting your hands dirty there, because Federer, you know, he does come across as a very funny, polite, charismatic, and just refreshingly down to earth. You know, such an extraordinarily powerful and successful man. But
prone to
so
tears as well.
Oh my God. Like there were times where I thought the first hour, I thought this is all a bit too bland, and this is, you know, it's fun to watch, but I'm kind of, you know, thinking about what I'm going to do afterwards. Then for the last half an hour, John, the match, you know, and where we see his greatest rivals just reduced to a blubbering mess because they realize they won't have this guy. They won't have the best around anymore to bring out the best in them. And they all just turn to mush. And if you are not crying when you're watching this, you'd want to check your pulse. I think the last third of this film is the most extraordinarily moving thing I've seen all year. So that saved it for me.
Wow. Okay. And this is on Prime Video, we should say. You know, you were talking about how, you know, it's sanitized and all that. But, but I was thinking, like, and we've had a slew of these from David Beckham to Arnold Schwarzenegger, but there's always going to be sanitization in these things if the star, whoever the subject is involved. But the flip side is, if you don't have them, you just get secondhand hearsay. So I think in the balance of things, you know, it pays off. Like the Arnie documentary, I really liked. The Last Dance from a couple of years ago with Michael Jordan, all about the Chicago Bulls. Like, I know some of them might go deeper, but when you have the people involved, I think sometimes if it's sanitized, you know, so be it. It's better that we have them telling their story if the story is really them, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I really don't know what to think about that anymore, because I do the same with biopics. Sometimes I think it's a terrible idea to have, you know, family and friends involved, because, you know, the Bob Marley one or Bohemian Rhapsody, they didn't really do anything for me. But Elton John was heavily involved in Rocketman, and that turned out to be great. So I don't really know. There has to be some sort of in-between. And I think, look, you were never going to have a Roger Federer documentary You were never going to have a documentary about Roger Federer that didn't show him in a positive light. You know, he's still very young. He is still very powerful. He's still very much involved. He's not going to let something grow that hurts that. So if we are to have something like this, look, it works. It's well-intentioned. Yeah. It's classy. And, you know, that final third does make it very entertaining. You do just come away expecting a little bit. You see that name, Ace of Capadia, and you think to yourself, this guy did Diego Maradona, Senna, Amy, three of the best portraits of iconic figures, you know, documentary portraits of iconic figures that were released in the last 10 years. It's going to be something special. It's not. It's just watchable.
Okay. And what would you say stars-wise then? So it's Federer, the final 12 days.
Yeah, I'd probably give 5 stars for that last half an hour. But look, 3 stars overall.
Okay. That sounds fair.
Yeah.
He's a great tennis player by all accounts. And I presume there's decent footage of him playing tennis, or is that not the point maybe?
Oh, there is, you know, and I should say as well, again, I mentioned there that I'm not the biggest tennis fan, don't know all that much about Federer, but I think a sports documentary is working well if it's paying attention to the newcomers in the audience, if by the end of it, you're actually interested in a sport that you very, you know, rarely ever considered beforehand. And that actually, that does happen here, you know, because I went in not knowing what Federer had really accomplished and I came out listing facts about him. So there are some decent clips in here and it is educational. So yeah, it's a solid 3-star stuff.
Yeah. Well, listen, folks, be warned, if you bump into Chris Wasser, he's going to begin conversations this Saturday night by telling you facts about tennis. That said, he is very good at reviewing movies. He gives 3 stars to Federer, the final 12 days on Amazon Prime, and previously a very strong 4 for The Bike Riders in cinemas. Chris, thanks a lot.
Nice one, John. Thanks.
Up next, the breakout star of season 3 of Bridgerton, Claudia Jessi, on Playing Eloise. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, it was somewhat remiss of me last week not to mention the second part of season 3 of Bridgerton, which returned to Netflix and, as you might expect, has been going gangbusters. It was probably remiss of me because we brought you kind of loads of Bridgerton interviews last month when the first part of season 3 landed. We had Nicola Coughlan, we had Queen Charlotte, all sorts of people. The third season is just eating up people's attention, and people who love Bridgerton are loving season 3 and part 2 especially. And we've seen Nicola Coughlan and Luke Newton be the stars of this season and their possible romance. Won't give you any spoilers if you haven't watched it. And it's, as I say, gone gangbusters. But some of the other cast, I suppose, doing the rounds, and in particular, Eloise Bridgerton, played by Claudia Jessi, who in this season has had a falling out with Nicola Coughlan's Penelope Featherington and is finding her own way in the world. You may have seen Claudia Jessi doing the rounds on American TV, a very sparkly young actress and great fun to talk to. So I spoke to her earlier in the week about playing Eloise Bridgerton in season 3 of Bridgerton, as well as Hannah Dodd, who plays Francesca Bridgerton, who's the new jewel in the Queen's crown, and also Jessica Madsen, who plays Cressida Cooper. And if you know Bridgerton, you'll know that she's kind of the villain of the piece. She's been unlucky in love and hasn't always been nice to people in her pursuit of a husband. But in season 3, we learn a bit more about her complicated backstory, which may have led her to all that. So I got to talk to Cressida, played by Jessica Madsen, Francesca Bridgerton, played by Hannah Dodd, and Eloise Bridgerton, played by Claudia Jessi. Such an array of acting talent on one screen. I don't know where to start. Claudia, if I can start with you, you know, your character, it seems to me, is, and I've watched all the series and Queen Charlotte and the first 4 of this one, so I do actually know what I'm talking about. So your character seems, you know, she's a deep thinker, and God bless her for that. And when season 2 ends, she's had a rift with the other person she shares a lot of her deep thoughts with. Was that an interesting part to explore for you, that, you know, you're losing your pal and you've nowhere to go in a way when the season begins?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure for any actor to see a big moment and a big shift for their character is exciting. And knowing that there was a big fallout and that was going to be really addressed in this sort of really dramatic way that it was exciting. And it was nice for me and Nicola. We've spent a lot of time being very sweet and kind of cute with each other. So it was quite nice to have a bit of like, yeah, a bit of intensity. But I also think it's important that she's sort of on her own journey this season as well. I think that's important for Eloise to sort of help her grow as well.
Yeah, and describing her as a deep thinker, do you think that's a fair assessment of Eloise?
Yeah, because I think I wouldn't say that anyone else is less of a deep thinker. I just think she just tells you what she's thinking. I think that is it. I don't think she's any more deep thinker than Anthony Bridgerton or Francesca or Cressida or Penelope. I don't think she is. I just think she's holding a megaphone being like, oi! And that's what I think she's just more okay with speaking about it.
That's a very important distinction to make. She just likes talking about it more than maybe other people do. That could go into the rest of your life. Hannah, you know, you're fresh to all this. What was it like to join this family? Intimidating, or I'm sure they were very welcoming and everything.
They were so lovely. They were so welcoming. But yeah, it was terrifying. I think I was very aware at first of how big the show was, and I was very intimidated to be joining. But then you go to set and they really just behave like it's some tiny little show, and you're just the nicest group of people ever. So yeah, it became normal. I mean, none of this is normal to me still, but it became normal.
It's not normal.
And your character is interesting in that, you know, the Queen, and I hope this isn't a spoiler, and we'll be very careful, I've been really good with spoilers all day, but she takes a real interest in you, and there's something about you that she seems to really gravitate towards. I think that's fair enough to say, right?
I hope so. Absolutely fine to say that. I think... it's become a thing over the seasons that the Queen will take interest in, that will really help you on the marriage march. So I think you know, all the young ladies are really kind of fighting for that attention. And that is one thing that Francesca does not want in her life, is attention. She hides behind her siblings. She's really happy to be at home by herself. So that it's probably that just means that she stands out, even though she's really trying not to.
Yeah, and she's charming as well. Jessica, sorry it's taken me so long to get to you.
Everything you said about Francesca, I feel like I can relate to Grace.
And the Queen takes an interest. Well, your character as well has, and again, going away from spoilers, but has an interesting trajectory in this one. I mean, she gets a bit more pally with Eloise than she would have been in the previous seasons. And we learn a bit more about maybe what makes her tick. I think that's fair to say as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we learn about her family life and what that's been like, which we've never seen before, which I think is quite a surprise for everyone to see the Cowper residency.
Yeah.
It was for me. Very dark. And I think it has a huge presence for itself as well.
Yeah.
We see her open up and become more vulnerable, and we see a very different side to her. And it's a joy to play.
Yes, of course. Any of you can answer this, but you know, on one level, this show has a lot to do with these young women wanting to get husbands and stuff. And I was talking to my wife, who's a big fan of it, as am I, the other night, and saying, you know, this is weird in a way, because that seems like an outdated kind of thing, that, you know, that's what a woman is meant to do. And yet this is often described as a very feminist show, and that it, you know, looks at female desire in a way that a lot of period dramas don't. Like, I think it probably has a foot in both camps. Or is there anything troubling about the fact that part of the show is women who want to find a husband? Claudia, maybe you can answer that. No pressure.
Thank you. Well, I think you could only be confident about that if you assumed that the women that do want husbands don't,
but they do. Right. Okay. Yeah.
And so like, there are women who are involved in the marriage market that absolutely do want husbands. So that's the thing. Sometimes I feel like it's a bit of a red herring.
Okay.
To take away from actually the importance of, female friendships, finding their own feet. And actually it is about romance, and the women who to desire a husband or a life partner isn't not feminist.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I was just playing devil's advocate, you know, for the purpose of the
interview. I know what you're up to.
Shocked. I've been rumbled. Hannah, you had a brief part in Eternals, which is this massive Hollywood production. Was that, here you are in Bridgerton, which is also a massive production, but being on the set of a Marvel movie for someone so young must be head spinning, I imagine.
Yeah, it was really weird. The thing is with
tell us what it's like.
The thing is with something like as big as that, and I was such a tiny part, guys, is that you go in for your bit, you don't really know. It's not this huge thing, because obviously like the bit that I was in was just that little bit. You don't
Which
have
is more terrifying, right?
Well, it's terrifying to not understand.
This isn't like leading up to the job. Sounds worse.
Thank you. But it was just like a couple of days work, and all I knew was like the scene that I had.
Yeah.
I understood the context of the whole thing, it probably would have been more terrifying, which this, I would say this was more terrifying, honestly.
Sure. Yeah. Well, don't undersell it though. You were still in a Marvel movie. That's more than most of us can say, you know? And Jessica, just on that, it being in these big movies, you were also in the last Rambo movie opposite Sylvester Stallone.
You did
act opposite Sylvester Stallone for that, which again must be one of those head turning moments in a career.
He was very cool, I've got to say. He's a cool guy. And I just screamed at him and asked him if we were going to die in a storm in some water and with a horse. In a water pool with a horse was quite fun.
That's
so
cool. Wow.
Yeah, he was cool.
Yeah.
You asked me about one of my Marvel films?
I've just been told time was out.
Is it going to be nice?
Next time. Well, listen, lovely to speak to all three of you, and continued success.
Thank you so much. Thank you, mate.
Bye. Cheers,
bye.
Guys.
Bye-bye. I love your wife. She likes the show.
Claudia Jesse, Hannah Dodd, and Jessica Madsen there, who play Eloise Bridgerton, Francesca Bridgerton, and Cressida Cowper, respectively there, talking to me about season 3 of Bridgerton, their roles in it, and my wife's fondness for it, as well as mine. I'm a Bridgerton fan. It does what it says on the tin. It's romantic drama done very well. And in a way, Bridgerton needs no, you know, approbation from me or indeed anyone else, because it's number one all around the world at the moment. Part 2 of season 3 landed last Thursday, the 13th of June. And as I say, millions, if not billions of people are watching it. And if you've been a Bridgerton fan, season 3 is doing the business. Up next, a new Irish movie, which is a remaking of Antigone called Twig. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, opening in select cinemas this weekend is Twig, an imaginative retelling of Antigone set against a gritty Dublin torn apart by gangland wars. At its heart is a young lady named Twig, who dreams of escaping with her lover Eamon, but her brother's deadly feud over the future of their late father's kingdom draws her back. After the death of her eldest brother Eddie, she goes in search of her other brother, Pauly, defying authority in favour of family loyalty. This stars, I should say, a great young actress, Shadé Malone, and was written and directed by Marion Quinn, who gave us the brilliant 32A, a great Irish coming-of-age story from a number of years ago. And I'm delighted to say Marion Quinn joins me now. Marion, hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Now, tell me this, and Sophocles, Antigone, you know, why mess with Sophocles? Why did you use that as the source material?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, one, I suppose I, you know, any young woman who went through drama school all remember Antigone, and we all love to play the part of Antigone because she's the original heroine, the girl speaking truth to power. So that's sort of always in the background of my mind. But I was a big fan of The Wire, and I love the epic scope and the ambition and the way that he told the story of the portrait of the city. But, you know, people said to David Simon, this is kind of Dickensian. And he said, I think it's further back. It's Greek. And I thought, yes, it is Greek. And it has that tragic element to it that is very sort of cathartic on some level. But I always wondered what happened to the women in that world. Mm. I was so curious. And so I have lived in the north inner city in Dublin in the past, and I just remember, and I know a lot of really strong, powerful women there. And I just thought it would be interesting to see the women in this world. You know, in the wars, they're continuing. The older men seem to send out younger men to die. And whether that's a so-called legitimate war or it's a gang war or whatever it might be.
And that's still the case today.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's the women who are left at home to pick up the pieces and bury the dead and to grieve. And so it's the wives, the sisters, the brother, the, you know, the mothers. So I suppose that's where I got my my initial idea.
Yeah, and not to trade playwrights with you, but it also sounds slightly Sean O'Casey-esque as well, with these women left behind while the men go off and do their silly things. The Dublin gang setting, you maybe I didn't set the scene enough in the intro, but it's imagined in that Dublin and maybe Ireland is in a kind of lockdown. We're in a kind of, I was going to say post-apocalypse, but we're in an apocalypse of ganglands, right?
Yeah, it's sort of an imagined Dublin, which sits a little bit out of time. Mm. So the police are different. They look more militaristic. And there are checkpoints throughout the city. And I mean, I did imagine it as a community that were sort of cordoned off as well. Mm. So within that community, this is the rule of law. Mm-hmm. That was something that I don't know if you know the film On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando, but you know that sense
I
of
could have had this. Class.
I could have been somebody. But this sense of a community that is, you know, that the ordinary society has turned its back on and that this is, and the rule of law is different in this community. So that's kind of what I was going for, something like that.
Right. And I presume this was conceived and indeed probably written before the Dublin riots last year.
Yes. Absolutely. So, and before the pandemic, where we did have lockdowns. And,
so it was written before the pandemic.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Now, I mentioned Sade Malone, who's brilliant in it. People, she's up and coming, I think it's fair to say. She's getting rave reviews in everything she's been in, particularly on stage. Was she always in your mind?
No, I met her through the casting process.
Okay, right. Yeah, so it's a simple... Yeah. Sometimes that can be a very dull question. Like, how did you find this great actress? We cast her. It was as simple as that.
Well, I worked with Louise Kiley, who's a really great casting director. And we spoke about authenticity and fresh faces and you know, really had an open call to try to find our best Antigone. And Sade was... Oh, from the first tape we saw, she had a complete performance. She was just there, very present, very... dynamic and very engaging.
Oh, she's brilliant.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's Irish-English, I think she'd describe herself, of Irish parents, and she's been here and she's been back and all. She's black, as are a lot of the cast. And what I love about it is that it's kind of unremarkable. The colour of their skin isn't, I don't think at any stage, mentioned. It's just they're people living in Dublin. Was that your intention, to make it unremarkable?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
I'm putting words in your mouth there.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think one of the discussions that I had with Sade in the initial casting stage was, well, first of all, is this okay? Because I wrote a story without any ethnicity in mind, but I was very aware of Dublin, but particularly North Inner City is very diverse. And I really did want the cast to reflect that. But at the same time, I'm a white woman. Is it okay for me? You know, we have all these questions we have to ask ourselves about representation. And so I did ask. I did ask people, and is this okay? You know, and I spoke a lot with Sade. And Sade said, you know, I don't think my ethnicity is the story. I think the story is the story of Antigone and Twig and her family. And I think that's what's happened. So once we cast Sade, we needed to make sure that her siblings had a similar mixed heritage, their mixed race, and so that they all fit together. Yeah. And and then Jade as the friend, I was really determined that it wasn't just going to be the family, and that obviously they are going to have friends who might be mixed race as well, and other people in all the extras. And all the that sort of casting as well.
Yeah, and what she does brilliantly in it is the centre of the story, I suppose, or one of the, if you can have more than one centre, is that draw between this criminal code that she's been born into and yet the love of family and the sacrifices she makes for that. She captures that brilliantly.
Yeah, she's really great talent, and I have no doubt that this is just a launching pad for her superstardom. But she, I liken her to an acrobat. Do anything, she can go here, she can go there, and also really hit all the emotional levels and then wear it lightly at the same time. You know, so even the sort of arc of the story, she was very careful. We worked together about, you know, hitting the notes at certain points, but not being too heavy and to try to keep a sense of play within the story.
Tell me this, the actor who plays the head of the gang is Breen Ethelburn, who people will know, I suppose, from being the head guard in Love, Hate and all sorts of other things. He does menace very well, doesn't he?
He's so...
Because he was menacing in Love, Hate as a guard or a detective. He's menacing in this.
He's just so good and so lovely, and you couldn't meet a nicer guy. And he's so funny. Like, at the end of every take, he had us laughing. But, no, Breen is great, and you need somebody without... without that sort of vanity, worried about, oh, I don't want to play somebody who doesn't appear, you know, who isn't really a nice guy. He's not afraid of that.
No, he certainly
and
isn't.
And also he really understands the Greek tragedy. He works with this theatre company called the Theatre of War.
Mm.
And they bring tragedies to places of conflict and discuss the, you know, the themes. And so he's very well versed.
Yeah.
In it. And no, we were so lucky to get him.
And is this, you know, it's art, but art is never created in a vacuum. Is this, you know, a clarion call that we need to be careful in Ireland with gangland? Or is it a clarion call to the world? Or is it saying wars are timeless and unfortunately always will be?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that, you know, the Susan McKeown, her beautiful rendition of Anthem, Leonard Cohen song.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. Did you have to, I'm a massive Leonard Cohen fan, did you have to get permission from his estate?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But Susan, who is a great singer, Grammy Award winning singer in her own right, had recorded that maybe 10 years ago on an album, Singing in the Dark. So I had always remembered that song. And, you know, oh, the wars, they will be fought again, and the holy dove will be sought again. I mean, for me, that's just that cyclical nature of our society. And, you know, we keep thinking that maybe we've, you know, reached some other place, but we haven't, and we just keep going back to it. And I think there's something about also just the nature of watching tragedies, like our niece, who's 15, came to the Dublin Film Festival opening night, and I thought, oh, she's
which, and it. I should mention, Twig opened the Dublin Film Festival.
Yeah, which was a really great honour. We were so thrilled to get that spot for the film and to debut there. But she came to the film, and I really thought, you know, she wasn't 15. And she just said, it's like Shakespeare on TikTok, and I can't wait to bring my friends to it, because there's a little bit of Romeo and Juliet tragic love story
absolutely,
in there too, which I think speaks to people.
That's a great way of putting it. Shakespeare on TikTok.
I'm not on TikTok.
I think you've just found the poster. Absolutely. Tell me this. I mentioned 32A, which is this gorgeous story about a 13-year-old girl receiving her first bra and falling in love. And it was just a delightful film. And I was just Googling you last night. You haven't made a full feature since that, sure you haven't?
Tragically, no, speaking of tragedies.
and can I ask why? Or?
It just didn't happen. It's not for the want of trying.
Okay.
I mean, I have a stack of scripts that I've written in between, and things that I thought were going to happen in TV series and various different things. And, you know, I just kept plugging away, and I started teaching in between, and I did a master's in screenwriting. And I suppose I really...
Why would you need to do a master's in screenwriting, having written 32A?
I've written a lot, but I think for my teaching, it was interesting, you know, and it was also interesting to me.
Fair enough. What do I know?
Yeah. But so just one of those things, like, just okay. the way it goes sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Indeed, indeed. Well, look,
the next one will be much quicker.
You're back with a very impressive new feature, which is called Twig, which is in select cinemas, but plenty of them. I checked all over the country. You had a screening of it, a special screening of it in the IFI this week, and then they also re-showed 32A in the same week as well.
Yeah.
The writer and director of Twig is Marion Quinn, and she was with me in studio. Marion, continued success.
Thank you so much, John.
You're trying to get us killed.
Continued chaos in the kingdom this morning as the death toll rises.
Everyone knows Leon set them two boys against each other. Leon! You coward!
She beat you there.
No!
Why would you let your fear stop you from doing what's right?
A little flavour there of Twig, which is in select cinemas from this Friday, the 21st of June. And you heard me talking to its writer and director, Marion Quinn. That is it for this week. Next week, wait till you hear this. Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I'll take you, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and I'll raise you Kevin Bacon. I'll take you, Kevin Bacon, and I'll raise you an Eddie Murphy. That's right, my friends. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Kevin Bacon, and Eddie Murphy are all on the show next week talking about the new Beverly Hills Cop movie. I guess you'd call it Beverly Hills Cop 4, Beverly Hills Cop Axel F, which is on Netflix from the week after next. I will be talking to the triumvirate that is Eddie Murphy, Kevin Bacon, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. So I very much look forward to that, and I hope you will join me for that. In the meantime, I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. If you want to get in touch with me on any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend, and have a safe week ahead.